Welcome back. We just had a few minutes there while we were doing our break, and I was reading through the chat, and I noticed that one of the questions that was popping up was, how come I can't get this to load? So I just wanted to take a couple seconds and just restate what you need to get this project up and running. First and foremost, you need a copy of Windows 8.1 or 8, preferably 8.1, because some of the code that we are doing might require 8.1.
Yep.
As well as you're going to need the Windows SDK 8. That's a good thing to download. If you've got an Express, I think that's a must if you have Express. If you have Professional or Premium or Ultimate, I think that gives you the option to download it while you're installing. So that's a thing that you definitely need. And, of course, you need Visual Studio 2013. That's what we're using to build it today. So those are just some of the things like that you definitely need to get up and running. So if you're running into issues where the project won't load or it's saying, you know, unsupported version, this is probably the reason why.
Also, there were some questions about how much work would this take to backport it effectively to Windows 7 or DirectX 10, for example. It's a fair amount of work simply because we've built some of these systems to buy into the Windows Store specifically for Windows 8.1 and things like that. So you do the initial setup part of what, you know, classes you use to get your application running, that part would have to change and so on. But the theory of how to build those buffers, for example, of when things should change and what you should update on your graphics device, that would stay the same, and things like that. So pretty much the theory would stay all the same. You still want to set up render loops and your main game loop the same with the update stage and render stage and things like that. But it would just be the initial classes that you would use to actually build a desktop app. You wouldn't need the Windows Store integration part because it's a desktop app. It's not going to respond to any of those. For example, like the snapping, like you had said, and mm-hmm. things like that. It won't be getting those calls as a desktop app, so you don't need the integration to the iframe view source and those kinds of classes. So if you wanted to make a traditional desktop app, or you're in Windows 7, you wanted to do that, you would do it in that way. But the theory and all the concepts that we're covering today, all the same ideas, same applications, you make a cube the same way, which we're going to see in a little bit, and so on. Shaders would stay the same, it's using the same shader language, HLSL. So that part won't change, but the initial, I guess, basically what we've just covered would be slightly different.
And the same thing goes for the backwards compatibility, right?
Right.
The theory is the same, but the syntax is going to be a little bit different. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, you can take everything that we're doing today and talking about and just basically extrapolate it and you know, change the syntax up a little bit.
Much like somebody else was pointing out that we're not using raw C++. That's correct. We're using an enhanced version of it.
The managed C.
With managed pointers, the new pointers that I pointed out early on and stuff like that. It's the same idea, same theory. You would just backport to whatever version of C++ you wish to use and go from there. So the concepts are all the same, different syntax for those different abilities if that's what you want to do. All right, so let's move on. We're going to go through creating and texturing and moving objects, all right? Again, we're going to cover initially some things we should know about. For example, how DirectX goes about making a mesh, vertices, triangles, etc. And then we're going to actually see a different an approach to creating one of these meshes through code in case you don't have a modeler, you know, that you can poke and be like, I need a character, make me one, please. Then we're going to manipulate that object and look at also how to finally get that mesh to render. And finally, from there, create more of those meshes without all of the extra overhead. So we're going to look at a simple way, or I guess I should say a common way, in which games will be able to show you the same thing, but in different places. We're just going to bend space and time so that we don't have all the overhead.
I love bending space and time.
It is, I mean, you get used to it after a while. It takes a little bit of skill. So the things we should know for this really is that DirectX games use polygons to represent objects and surfaces. Typically, they will be triangles. You can use quads in different rendering systems and other engines and that, but we're going to stick with triangles for today. 3 points are easier to manage than 4. And we'll go from that kind of perspective. Those meshes are then going to be passed to the shader pipeline during the rendering stage of the game loop to be processed and displayed. So most games store this mesh data for their objects in external files from a modeling program, for example. There's a bunch of them out there. There are free ones out there that you can get that you can bring in, you know, make some kind of character and export it in a common format like a DAE file or what's that other one that we use commonly?
FBX.
FBX, there you go. Thank you. That's the one I was thinking of specifically. And like I said, Visual Studios actually has a model viewer little mini program inside it. So you could open up, bring that asset in to the Visual Studio project itself for the game, double-click on it, and see that model. And you can even manipulate it in there as well if you need to make little changes to it. So that is a neat expansion that is going on in Visual Studio, and I just wanted to highlight that because a lot of people don't realize that that's actually there, but it is. So you can take a look at a model, even if you don't have the modeling program because you're not an artist. Why would you have that software? Maybe you just have the code suite. Now you at least can visualize and see what it is you're supposed to see in the game, and then verify that those two things sync up. So that's a great little addition. Now, another approach is to store those simple meshes, or for simple objects like barrels, they're really just cylinders, crates, I mean, they're cubes, and so on, little power-ups, all the iconography that is 2D that faces the camera, right? They're just quads. And so on. We don't need a modeler to make us that model, export it in a file, and then pull it in to display it. We could just embed those vertices into an array within a class and then just say, create me a cube, create me a cube, create me a cylinder, and put them wherever we want. So that's another way to do it for simpler models. There's no need for that external modeler to bulk it out and make you an actual file that you then have to worry about parsing. Mm-hmm. You have to bring it in the right form. If it's DAE versus FBX, things can be labeled differently or different shapes or different orders. You have to worry about all that stuff. We're coders. Let's just code it right into a class, and it'll be enough for today. We just need two cubes and a cylinder for the mat, so we're going to go with that approach for today. So the basic meshes can also be written right into the code like that, and that's what we're going to be concerned with today. All right, so let's move on and actually look at creating a mesh itself. So in most games, the mesh for a game object is loaded from that file, and it contains specific vertex data. So the ordering of these vertices is app-dependent, effectively, but they're usually serialized in either strips, fans, or lists. Mm-hmm. Okay, and here's, for example, some images on what I'm talking about. That vertex data, it can come from any of the software sources, or it could be created manually internally, or you could have even just written it by hand in a text file. That would have been also suitable. But it's up to our game to really interpret that data in a way that our vertex shader later on can effectively process and render. So if we were to use something like strips, when the vertices are stored in strips, each vertice from the previous polygon, or rather two of them, are going to be used in the next polygon. So you can sort of think about it, you're going to do this, and then effectively you're going to do that, and then you need to flip it again, so that each two vertices in the previous thing in that order are in the new triangle. So you can see that there on our image. We have vertice 1, 2, 3. Then when we add vertice 4, it reuses 2 and 3 to complete the next triangle. And then when we add 5, it uses 3 and 4, and so on and so on, and sort of unfolds it like that. It's like when you're folding up origami and then you like open it up, you get a creased piece of paper and it's all these triangles all over. Sort of looks like that. That's effectively the essence that what you're trying to do. Now, that can be very difficult for certain things, such as if I wanted to make just a basic house with your cube with, you know, the slanted roof, could you pick one of the corners and now tell me every corner after that to perfectly unfold that house made up of triangles, you know, two for each side of the cube and two for each side of the roof, into one strip where they follow this pattern? All right, a lot of people have trouble unraveling things mentally or even on paper into that setup. So it can be hard to do it by hand in that manner. Mm-hmm. So that brings us down to lists. But the nice thing about triangle strips is it saves memory. Yeah. Because now I don't have all the duplicate data. Triangle 1 isn't made up of vertex 1, 2, and 3. And then triangle 2 is made up of, well, three new points again. As you see in the triangle list, that's exactly what happens. It easily easier for people to mentally break down, because now you just have to say, where is this triangle? Now, where's the next triangle? Where's the triangle on this side of the roof? Where's the triangle on that side of the house? And so on and so on, and just state all of those vertices. So it's much easier to work with in a triangle list, but now we have duplicate data because every triangle should be probably sharing two points with another triangle, but you've written it twice. Okay, so the triangle list is sort of the most inefficient way to do this, but then again, at the same time, it's the easiest for people to work with mentally and to lay things out. Mm-hmm. Then we have triangle fans. It's another way to optimize triangles. It's great for doing things like people's eyes or large fanned out surfaces, obviously, because you basically just give it a center point or an origin fanning point, and then you just do all the points around the outside, and they all connect.
I believe that's how we did the mat in our demo, isn't it?
For the top of the cylinder, that is sort of how that is laid out, yeah. You'll see that the texture stretches in a funny way because we haven't bothered, using our amazing art skills as programmers to make it all pretty. But yes, that's effectively what is sort of happening there. It's that kind of stretching system. So the fan form, it's similar to the list, the strip, in the way it works. But again, it reuses now the origin point and only one of the last points in the array of vertices that you've listed to make that fan. So it's slightly different, but same idea. Now, because our demo game doesn't require any complex models, we won't be loading any external mesh data or files, but resources and tutorials on this topic can be found all over the web. Just Bing it, and you'll find it. And if you want a more complex model, you'll have to import it, parse the file, and take a look at it. So, now, creating the mesh itself, really the minimum data required per vertex is position in some kind of local space. All right, where is this vertex? So in that previous Windows Phone Direct 3D template that I had opened up there for a second, we had that little multicolored cube spinning around in Module 1 just to verify everything was running. And I'm going to refer to that one a couple times here, just so we can see two different implementations, our game as well as their version of it, so you can get used to the way of doing things without just memorizing specifically how we coded it. So the minimum amount of data that we require for any given vertex is that vertex position in either 2D or 3D space, depending on what it is you're trying to draw. And a cube is made up of 8 vertices. Right, so there's 4 corners at the top, 4 corners at the bottom, there's your 8 vertices, and they're all connected in a triangular fashion. So in the code here, you can see that they have laid out their simple cube vertex is just basically their wrapper class to talk about this location data. They've made an array of them called cube vertices, and it's basically just a vector or a float 3, however you want to refer to it. It's 3 points of data, once for your X, your Y, and your Z coordinate of that vertex. So what they've done is, if you take a look at the first list, there are 8 float 3s separated by another 8 float 3s on the right. We'll talk about what the right side data is in a minute, but the first column of data is the vertex positioning for each of those vertices. And you can see that they've decided to do the top face first of the cube. So they've listed it at minus 0.5x, positive 0.5y, minus 0.5z. So that's our back left corner effectively. And then positive x, positive y, negative z. So we have the other corner. All of the y's are going to be positive because it's that top face of the cube. All right, so we're specifying everything up here. So they've raised it up half a unit above the origin. The origin in this case for the cube is that center position. So they've moved everything up, and then they just spread one out into each corner at the top. And the bottom half of that column are the 4 vertices at the bottom of the cube. Again, half a unit below the origin point. Move it out to each corner half a unit in X and Z position. Now, all of that data gives us, that would have been the basic information we need. We didn't actually need that other column, but because they wanted to make it colorful and give us that cool technicolored look, what they've done is that other column is the color point they would like at that vertex. Okay, so they've, again, color can be split into red, blue, and green channels, mm-hmm. RGB. All right, so if we said full on R, full on B, and full on G, so 111, which I believe you can see is the third row there, that's our white color. So the corner that is white is that third row, and that's the position 0.5, 0.5, 0.5 in this case, and that's how they've done it. And then they just change the colors as they go around the cube with that secondary column of data. And that's not uncommon to include color information into vertice information. And we do that for simple games, especially on mobile, where they do simple shading just using that vertex data. That's quite common. As you can see, the graphics card interprets that rather nicely. It takes the color data from one vertex and the next and blends from one color to the other nice and smoothly. So you can do some neat effects just by using that color vertex data that you might want to embed with your vertices. Now, you can embed other information such as lighting. Okay, that can also go in there. You can do UV coordinates. Okay, so a UV coordinates, since positionally we call them X, Y, and Z for where this vertex is, if I wanted to tell you what part of a 2D texture to paint to that vertex, we need a 2D coordinate system. So we've called them U and V, and that's where a UV texture coordinate gets its name. So it's basically saying where in X and Y on my texture should I take that piece of color and stick it on this vertex? And so then you can blend from this vertex to this vertex across the texture using UV coordinates from this point, but on my texture file. And that's how they map effectively a texture onto wrapped around on a cube. Now you have to do it in a certain manner, obviously, because you are taking a 3D object that you've unwrapped into a bunch of triangles and then stuck it on your 2D image and then painted over it, and now you want all that data to come back. There is a specific way to do that, but that's known as UV texture coordinates and UV texturing, and we'll briefly take a look at that. We'll describe that as well, but that's something more that falls into the realm of a modeler. Mm-hmm. He's going to be worried with unwrapping the model, even if it's a complicated humanoid, laying out all the individual triangles or quads that make up that person, and then painting properly their face over it or whatever to get it to appear. We just have to interpret that data. Another type of data is known as a normal, and really it's just a vector coming up off of a surface. Okay, so you could think of it as if this was the top of the cube, and I put my other hand on it, the direction my thumb is pointing would be known as your normal for that face. In this case, though, it's the normal for the vertex. So it's vertexes represent really the corners of the cube, so we would want them coming off on a 45 degree angle in all directions, sort of off that corner of the cube. That kind of data can be put in there, and we use that for lighting. All right, so that will help us calculate ways shadows are casted, the way light reflects on a shiny surface and causes that sort of halo-y glow on a metallic surface. You get those hot spots, we call them. Okay, that's all done through normal data and interpolating between those normals. So that can also be embedded into your vertex data. Now, their case, in their little cube demo, if you look at the simple cube vertex, if you right-click on that structure and go look at it, they have specified just a point, X, Y, Z, and their color data, RGB. In our demo, we're going to take it a little bit further, and we're going to put something else in there. So how do we specify to DirectX that a vertex will have certain pieces of information over others? That's effectively what we need to look at. We now know that they want color data and they want positional data in there for that cube. So what they've done is the first step is to create sort of this input element description, and there's a D3D11 input element DSC structure flag that we can use, and we're going to set it as a const because it's not going to change once we tell it this is how our cube is set up, or how the information for each vertice in our cube is set up. That's never going to change over the course of our game, at least not in this game. You may have a reason for changing it later on. And so what we're going to do is we're going to have all of the cube's vertices stored in code, and then we're going to load them into memory. That's great. But in order to actually render them, we need to transfer and store those coordinates and colors on the GPU's memory. So we got to move all that data to the graphics card. And like I said earlier on in the first segment, we can't constantly be accessing that data. It's going to cause some problems. We're going to lose frame rate. We don't want to do that. So we'd like to do as few things as possible. In this case, we'd like to push over the description so that it knows the format of all of these and then never touch that again because that format's going to stay the same. We just then later on say, could I have a buffer of these? And it goes, oh, okay, sure, I know what you're talking about now. Here's a buffer with enough of those vertice spaces. Go ahead and fill in that information with whatever you need. Now, to get that vertex in there, we need to set up an input layout interface. And here's the code again from the sample. First, it creates that description. It states the name of each of the data elements, okay, which are, we will refer to in the shader at some point when we go to render this. So it's going to have position and color. So we've just named them as such, position and color, right in the description. The next element after that, in this case, we've put 0 for both. And that value is appended to that name in case you have, for example, 3 colors for some reason, or something that's named the same, that next element is just sort of appending, so you know this is position 0, position 1, position 2, because some complex shaders will distort the position of things, right? So you'll need to know the different stages of this guy morphing into, you know, some big crazy creature. So you might have to label them similarly, but that index lets you know which position we're dealing with at that point. So that's what that variable does. The next variable, or parameter rather, in there is our format for the data that the position or the color is. In this case, you'll notice that they both say the same format. And if you take a look at it and try to figure out what it's trying to tell us, it says R32, G32, B32 as floats. So basically we're saying we want 32-bit red value, a 32-bit green value, and a 32-bit blue value. But why would I need that for position? It makes sense for color, red, green, blue, great. I got a good range of colors, right? Why are we also using that format for position? It, just so that we don't have a bunch of the same structures for 50 different things that effectively could be used with the same amount of memory, we need an X and a Y and a Z, RGB, 3 things, right? And then we need 32 bits again because it's the same data range that we're going to use, which is a float. So we just say R32, B32, G32 as well. And it doesn't matter that it's positional or color data. They're both 3 valued floats, and that's it. So that's nothing to be confused over. It's not a mistake in the code. That is correct. They are both supposed to be the same, even though one looks like we're talking about color with position. And so that's what those values are for. There are other ones that allow you to do 2-dimensional colors or just one float or whatever, depending on what kind of things you're passing in, such as an alpha value for RGBA and so on. The next one, 0, again, for both, it specifies the input slot parameter. We're not going to talk about that. Just set it to 0, you'll be fine. It's more of an advanced thing that you might need later on to do fancy effects. And then next comes the aligned bit offset value. So that 0 and that 12 in those buffer descriptions. Basically, what this is saying is, where is this data for this element in the overall buffer from the starting point? So position, it's the first thing I'm going to state. So it starts right at the beginning. So I say 0. Mm-hmm. Zero bits in, or bytes in, sorry. And then position takes up 4 bytes for red, 4 bytes for green, 4 bytes for blue, which are X, Y, and Z. So that's 12 bytes of information. So color can't start until 12 bytes later. So we say 12 for our parameter there for the offset, so it knows where the color element now starts. Now, we're labeling them logically in order that they happen anyways. So why do we need to put that number in? Well, it's just in case you don't label them in that or you inject some code later, that's why it's there, just to give you the flexibility to do it in any order you want. But as we'll see in the code, there is actually a little shortcut defined that we can use in DirectX now that just says, I've put them in the right order. Please calculate this for me, and it'll do so. So that's a nice new feature, again, that I've noticed that has come in over the later versions of DirectX that we can now use. So you don't have to do all the math in your head and type out the right number of bytes for each little piece of information as you're making this description. So after that is D3D11 input per vertex data. So that second last parameter, it allows us to input what kind of class of data this is, so that the graphics card or graphics device knows how to handle it a bit better. We can obviously do certain optimizations for certain kinds of data, and this is going to allow us to sort of know what's going on. So we've said that it's an input per vertex data, so we're letting it know this is going to have to change for every vertex. The color and position are going to change every time I talk about a new vertex. more or less. So we've gone ahead and set that so it knows that this information is going to constantly shift. And then the last thing we can't use, the final parameter there, that 00, can't be used because of the fact that we actually said input per vertex data, because what it's meant for is our instance data step rate. So we could say, use this same information for four primitives and then change it. So maybe they all have the same color. And you know that in your game, these things all have the same color. You can use that to signify how many things to draw before changing the color value. But in this case, because we're saying it changes every time, every vertex, that value has to be zero so that it always updates in sync as well. And it won't let us use anything else when we put input vertex data in there. All right, so I did it again. There we go. Gotta stop hitting that scroll wheel. So finally, the next thing we want to do is we need to create the input layout on the D3D device. We've, again, just defined it on ours. We haven't actually gotten it over there. So that takes care of the description part. Now we can create the actual input layout on the graphics device itself. And we do this by doing something similar that is shown here. The D3D device, we tell it to create an input layout. We pass in our description, so in this case, the vertex description that we just created. We tell it the size of that thing, and we can just use array size to figure that out. So it'll get the array size of our vertex description and fill that in. And then the rest of these file data is a pointer internally in the demo. That'll be different than yours. But basically, you have to hand it the data of those vertices and the length of that data into there, and it will hand you back your reference to your input layout that you're then going to refer to in the future. So that's that process. So that line of code, that's how you do it, but it's going to need to change each individual time you use it, and we'll see that in our game, how it slightly shifts to be able to actually do that. So at that point, we now need to create the buffer for all that data based upon that layout and then push it over. So that's the next stage. There is a lot of setup in DirectX just to go into getting something set up to render. But once you have it there, then you can manipulate it and you realize the process stages, it becomes second nature. It's really make a description, create a layout with that description, create a buffer with that layout, push all my data into it. Those are the steps that we're gonna keep doing for any object that we would create, whether it's a cube or a model or a cylinder, it doesn't matter. Those are the same kind of stages that we're going to step through. And that's why we're highlighting all this, so that you can see this is what you have to go through, the process you have to go through to get to this point of actually rendering something. So the vertex buffers, they contain that list of vertices for each polygon in the mesh. All right, the vertex shader runs on the GPU, and it reads from that buffer and interprets that data based on the input layout that we just finished specifying. So to actually create that buffer on the card itself, we need to set up effectively a D3D11 sub-resource data structure and the D3D11 buffer description structure for that vertice group that we want to create. So the D3D11 buffer description and the D3D11 sub-resource data structures, they're there to ensure that DirectX understands the physical memory layout of that buffer, including the size of each vertex element in that buffer and the maximum size of the vertex list itself. We can also control access to the buffer memory here and how it's traversed if we need to. In this case, we're not really going to need to. It's beyond the scope of the tutorial, so we're not going to cover any of that stuff. But after we've configured this buffer, we call the create buffer command, which you can see is the last line there, to actually go about manifesting that buffer on the graphics device. All right. So if we had more than one object, we'd have to go through a similar process to create a buffer for each unique model that we wanted so that the models would exist, and then we can start the process of trying to draw them. All right, so this information here, the sub-resource data, those p-system mems and sys-mem pitch and sys-mem slice pitch, those are all those things that allow us to manipulate how it's going to be traversed, and we don't need to worry about any of that. It's going to be nice, straightforward, just read it as it is in our buffer. We're not doing any crazy optimizations for right now because we don't need to push the hardware to the limit just to draw two cubes. Hopefully not. So we're just going to leave all that set up as such, and we're going to build that buffer description by passing that information in and then create the buffer with that line of code.
It seems like a lot, but after you do this a little bit, it starts to become, like you said, second nature.
It does, and yeah. you're going to make a function that's going to help you do these kinds of things occasionally, and classes that hold my cube, so now I can literally just say new sumo cube, and there's another sumo player running around in the environment, right?
Yeah, it just goes back to you need that solid foundation, yes. And once you got your foundation in place, you can start putting your walls up, so to speak.
Exactly. The foundation is the most important, and since this is, you know, from the ground up, the beginner kind of entry point, that's what we're going over. So, again, you're going to probably take most of this code right out of that other project, the sumo project that you have now, and start adding your own classes that do the exact same process to make a sphere, for example. Sphere is going to be a little more complex than a cube, obviously, because mm-hmm. you got a lot more vertices to deal with, okay, and so on. So maybe you want to start with a trapezoid or some other shape or a diamond or something like that that's just a manipulation of the cube layout before you get into that approach. But all of these steps are going to be the same, creating a buffer, you know, make sure that buffer gets over there before we can go on to actually getting it up on screen. So the vertices aren't the only thing that we need, okay? Here's a bunch of random dots. What did you draw today, Mickey? it's not that useful, right? Just having the dots. And that's all we've told the graphics card about so far.
Yeah.
Here's a list of points in space with colors. Wow, that's pretty. Right? Right now, it's a collection of colored stars in the environment. That's it. That's mm-hmm. all it sees is stars. So we need to give it a little bit more information than that. So a mesh isn't created out of vertices, it's created out of a bunch of polygons that we haven't really told the graphics device about, right? It goes back to our triangle strips or triangle list, triangle fans, those things, the connections. We haven't told it anything about the connections, it just has 8 dots. So we need to envision each vertex as having sort of an ID, so we know, or a name, right, an identification number that's assigned to it, that represents its position in that buffer that we made. There's 8 vertices sitting in that buffer, and we'll just label them 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 as we go through. Now we need to create a list of triplets that represent each triangle in that cube using those ID numbers. Okay, so this approach is called indexing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've named the array that holds the indexes appropriately, cube indices there. That might be a little small, unfortunately, sorry about that. And it's just going to be I've just made it an unsigned short array because it just needs a positive number from 0 to whatever. And I've grouped them by the triangles of the faces, and I've color-coded it just to make it easier for people to see there. It's not color-coded in the code, obviously, if you go look at their example again. But this is the line of code that sets up the indices for the multicolored cube in that little template that we set up. So it specifies the 0, 2, 1, so index 0, 2, and 1. So we got 3 vertices out of our buffer. That's going to make our first triangle. Now, that's half of a square of the face of a cube. Mm-hmm. So we need the other triangle. And again, it's going to share 2 of those. So the other one is 1, 2, and 3, and that's your other triangle. Now, it's important that you get the order of these indices correct, because if you don't have it right, by default, you won't see anything if you're looking at it, because it's actually flipped around. And you're going to be looking at the back. It doesn't by default render the back of anything. Why would we need to render the inside of a dice? There's nobody inside the dice. What good would that possibly serve? Why waste time? So by default, it only renders one side of any polygon.
And that's referred to as backface culling.
And that's what backface culling is, exactly, in this case. And you can do frontface culling. It just means don't look at the front, look at the back only, right? And you'd see nothing, except when you looked at the cube, instead of seeing nothing, you'd see nothing from this side, but you'd see the inside of the other side. So you do see something, but it looks like this weird pushed-in box that you see. And that's a common stumbling step for some people, is that they have the wrong backface culling mode set because it's in your shader, mm-hmm. right? So they might be borrowing somebody else's shader, not realizing that for whatever reason the guy used the right-hand rule versus the left-hand rule. And what I mean by that is if you specify the vertices, and in this case 0, 2, 1, so if I put my hand at wherever 0 was, and then I wrap my fingers towards 2 and then towards 1, okay, the direction your thumb points is the front of that triangle. Okay, so again, if it was up here and I put my palm at zero and then I wrap towards two and then one, so now it's pointing at you. So I should see this as the front face of my triangle. But that's with my left hand. Some people do it with the right hand, right? So they want front face this way. But the triangle, if I do the same thing from 0, 1, 2, and 0, 1, 2, my thumbs are pointing in different directions, so you see nothing versus seeing something, depending on what kind of culling you're doing. So something to be aware of, the order of these indices is important for specifying the vertices of each polygon in this setup. So that's how we set up effectively that list, and this it saves us sort of some of the other craziness that might have to go on to make the cube. We effectively now have our 8 vertices, which lists 12 triangles, okay, which creates our entire cube. If we didn't do it in this manner, you'd have to make 36 vertices to do your 12 triangles to do your cube, right? Because instead, all that duplicate data, we use the same corner point for one triangle, two triangle, the top triangle, the other top triangle, the other back triangle, the other. You use it for 6 different triangles, right?
Yeah. So it would work, but it would take a lot more memory.
It would work. It would just take more memory because you'd have to duplicate now 36 vertices to specify each for each triangle in the triangle list. So this is using an indexed list of vertices to create less triangles. So now, even though we are going to use the triangle list approach, we're saving some memory because we haven't listed all that duplicate data. Mm-hmm. Instead, we've just listed the indices of the triangle and set them up in that manner. So that's why we have done it in this fashion, or rather, that's why the demonstration did it in this fashion. We're going to do a similar approach in ours. So at this point, we have now successfully moved all of the data that makes up the cube's mesh over to the graphics device. However, to render it to the screen, we still need a few more pieces of the puzzle, like a view and a projection matrix that represents our camera and our Windows settings. And by window, I mean the screen view. So a vertex shader then interprets the polygons and so on, and which we're also missing, so we're going to have to get to that. So rather than go into all of those things, let's take a look at the difference and similarities between the samples code and what we just went over in the sumo wrestling demo code. We're going to take a look at the vertices in the demo game. They contain position, okay, NUV, and normal data, whereas the sample from the template just has color and position. Mm-hmm. So I've dropped color in the demo, and I've added in UV and normal data so we can do some lighting and some texturing as well. All right, so that provides all that support we need for textures and lights just using that extra 2D and 3D vector effectively that we're going to store in there. The code to set up the D3D device to handle these vertices and the extra data, it's still very similar to the sample project's code. The difference is that I've moved it into some other more logical places so that when we build a larger game, it makes a little more sense. It's a little bit easier to locate each of it for each different object. Okay, in theirs, it's pretty straightforward. They pretty much just all put it in the same class. Here's all the buffer description. Here's pushing it all out. Here's laying out all the vertices and rams it all out. It's great for looking at exactly what you need to do. Okay, and it's nice laid out point by point by point in that one. That's why I wanted to show you that template. But now we're going to see how I've taken that and effectively moved the code and integrated it into other pieces of the system. So I've created a mesh object class, first of all, and that's going to just be the game's base mesh class. So a mesh, we know, needs a list of vertices, for mm-hmm. example. Okay, so and a list of indices, so we don't have to duplicate that vertex data. That's what's going to be really in the mesh object. Just those arrays declared, that's it. It doesn't actually make anything. Okay, it's just that's what's in that base class. From there, I've extended that to have a cylinder mesh class and a sumo mesh class. The cylinder mesh class makes cylinder. The sumo mesh makes our little 8-bit sumo wrestler mesh, our cube. and that's pretty much all there is to it. So we're going to look at the sumo mesh and that mesh object now. I'm just going to pop over to that. So just bear with me here. All right. So if you take a look at this code here. So first off, meshes folder, like I said, I broke things up. We have a mesh object class. Okay, and if you look at the header, it just has the render function. That's that part that we saw earlier. We're going through our array of objects. Mm-hmm. It's saying render, render, render on each one. So as a, as the base thing, that's what this is going to be called. And it does nothing. If we go to it right now, it would just be blank. Yeah. But that's going to need to be extended. That's why it's marked as virtual, so that we can override it with a proper render for whatever mesh object class this thing is. This class is also marked as abstract, so you can't make any that way, and so on in your code by accident. So the other things we said we needed, a vertex buffer and an index buffer, and the vertex count and the index count for those buffers. So how many points do we need for this object, and then how many indices do we need to make all of the polygons using those vertices to make that object. And then the buffers is where that data is actually going to be stored. And you can see these are generic ID3D11 buffers, and that's why we need to do that description and that buffer layout, is because there we don't know what the data is going to be. It's just a generic buffer. Mm-hmm. You're just asking the graphics device, could I have some memory? I'm going to put some stuff here. So it doesn't know that format. That's why we have to set up that description. That's why we have to, you know, build out that whole buffer chunk first to let it know how the data is arranged, because we're just using generic buffers. So I'll just pop over to the CPP. And the constructor, because again, this is just going to be an abstract class, doesn't really do anything. It doesn't have anything in it itself. The render function does have some codes written in, and it's basically showing you that we'd like to use our vertex buffer. Okay, so we tell the 3D context that got passed in here, so the rendering device we're dealing with, I would like you to please set up the vertex buffers using this description that we pass the address to, and basically we have to give it a stride and an offset, which is the length of the vertex system. All right, so let me just zoom in a bit. This is probably a little bit too small to read. Oh, come on, there we go. There we go. Center that. I've also put up the line numbering because somebody was asking for that earlier, so now they can easily locate where it is that we are in the code. So the mesh renderer, as I said, the stride, it's basically how long is the data we need per vertex in this case for this buffer. So I hand it the size of our PTN vertex. What does PTN vertex stand for? Well, really it's a vertex that has our position, our normal, and our texture coordinate data. And I'm going to keep losing, sorry about that, I'm going to keep losing the zoom level every time I switch files here. Why won't it let me zoom in this time? All right, so it's just a three float and two floats and a two float, because we need our position data, which has X, Y, and Z, our normal data, which has X, Y, and Z, and our texture coordinate, which just has a U and a V. Mm-hmm. So I'll jump back. There we go, back to full size. So now that we've told the graphics device about our vertex buffer, we also want to tell it about our index buffer. Okay, that's our next line there. And you can see that we just need to pass in where it is. We say mindexbuffer.get, and that gives us the memory address of where it starts, gets passed in. We tell it the format of the index buffer. And before these formats, it's similar to the ones we were using where we were saying RGB32s. Mm-hmm. Only in this case, it's just a simple number. So we're just going to pass it in as what effectively that means is a red 16 unsigned integer. So it's just a single number that gives us that many bits of precision. That's all we're going to need. We're not going to have 50 billion indices, yeah. Hopefully, because that's not the point. So we can pass it in as that. Now it knows that buffer, how big it is, how big the stride is, and it can now use those. And we get to then specify which one of those three topologies we wish to use. Do we want to hand it as a triangle list, or a triangle strip, or the fan?
Yeah.
Okay. In this case, just keep things simple and how we label everything. We're using the triangle list. It's inefficient, but it still works for our purposes. So we've passed in that primitive topology as a triangle list, and it now knows that every set of three indices describes a new triangle, and it doesn't relate to any of the other triangles as far as it's concerned for saving data, so then it just asks for the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and just lays them out all independently. Finally, at that point, we can say draw indexed, which basically just instructs the graphics card to go through a certain number of indices in the array and draw all of those primitive shapes. So we tell it how many we have, and it'll run through the whole thing, the whole array, draw every one of those little pieces of our cube, or our mesh object in this case, since it's not actually a cube. So that's what the base class really just does for us. If I go over to the sumo mesh class, I might as well start at the header. There's really not much there.
No.
Okay. It's just going and basically setting up that we are a mesh object. That's it. Mm-hmm. All right. So the CPP, on the other hand, goes through. It needs to know about the graphics device that we're going to be dealing with. All right. We're going to set up a buffer description and our sub-resource data, which we saw the sample doing. We're gonna have to build those. We need to tell it all about the vertices we're going to use. This column here is the positional data for each of the 8 vertices. You can see we have 8 rows. And again, it's exactly the same as the demo or the sample. It's centered around 0, 0, and they're all a half unit in each direction to get all of our points. That's the way I've laid it out, just to keep it consistent for you. And then this next column, though, is no longer color. All right. This is our normal data. So in which way that surface of, if I put my hand down and I put my hand on it and I point my thumb upwards, that's the direction that the normal data is, and that allows us to do lighting calculations. In this case, we want it coming off of the corner of the cube as if projecting into infinity away from the origin. So all I've done is just used a simple 1 or -1 value of the way that point of that cube is pointing in 3D space. So the front right corner, top corner, would be pointing up and over to the right and forward off the cube. So it's 1, 1, 1. The next point over is pointing down, or below it actually is pointing down. So it's pointing still forward, still to the right, but down. So it's -1 for that one. And I've just gone through and done every combination of them. That matches. You can see that the symbols actually match up with the symbols of our positional data. That's the easy way to figure it out in this case for a cube. So our positive point is all positive for the normal. The one that has positive x and y but negative z is positive x and y and negative z for the normal. And that's going to give you the proper layout for the normals of those corners in a cube so that our lighting works no problem. So it's the most basic example that I could think of. That's why we went with 8-bit sumo wrestlers. And there it is. Now, the last part is UV texture data. This part, again, it's a little bit different because you're translating a 2D point from a texture to where you want that to land on the cube. Now, what I've done here is I've used the data points, and you can see there is a, if you want to take a look at the texture file, I'm going to show you this for a second. Resources here. So again, Visual Studios has a nice built-in texture viewer. There you go. This is the texture for the sumo. Now, you might remember not seeing any red lines whatsoever on the sumo. That's because actually what I've done is, because of the index triangle layout, I can't actually use this texture, which is from a game that we'll be doing in tomorrow's MVA. But what I've done is I wanted the top part for the hair on the top of his head, so we knew which way was up on the cube. And so I've actually given the coordinates, which are coming right down here and right across the top. Those are the coordinates I've used for all of the triangles so that we get that top head hair piece on top of our cube, and then the rest is just below that by 1 pixel and to the left by 1 pixel, so that everything else on the cube is skin color. Mm-hmm. And I'm not actually using 3/4 of this image. And that's the sort of neat thing about the ability of the UV textures, is that you don't have to use a whole texture for any given object. So you can end up doing, if you've done 2D games before and done texture atlasing or sprite sheets, it's the same kind of idea, but applied to maybe multiple 3D objects or an animated 3D object. You can tell the vertices what part of the texture they should be showing at any given time, and then you could move through the texture or change what they see on that texture itself, or on the model itself from that texture. So that's what these values here are telling us. Okay. Now, the top left corner in UV is 0, 0, right? The far right is 1, and the bottom is 1, so the it's a little bit different than maybe the coordinate system you would expect. 0, 0 is top left corner, and 1, 1 is bottom right. All right, so not to get confused there. And all those numbers punched in here give us that shape that we want. Now, from there, that's great. We have all of our vertices lined up with all of the lighting data, with the texture data we need. We now need to go into actually making the polygons using those vertices. So again, we have our little triangle list in groups of threes saying which indice, or which vertex rather, so which one of these eight rows, do we use to make this triangle? So 0, 1, 2, so we're using this guy, then this guy, then this guy to make that first triangle of the negative x face. And then we need to use 1, 3, and 2, so this these three here, to make the next triangle, and so on through the system. So each one of these is a triangle on its own using the vertices from that list, exactly as the demo sort of did. My ordering is slightly different for what I was doing, also partly because of how I do the texture UV mapping. After that, again, we have to fill in our vertex count. There's 8 of them. We have to fill in our index count, which we can just calculate by getting the array size of the indices. And now we have that data. We can start building our buffer description. Okay. Some of the flags that we set before aren't in this one that compared to the ones in the sample. And there might be a new one too, just because of different settings that I needed. But these are pretty much going to be your basic settings. You're going to tell it to use it as default. There are some advanced buffers, descriptions, and usages that you can set up, but we just need a basic buffer. The size of it is going to be, well, however many vertices I have, multiplied by however big one vertex is in terms of my PNT data, my position, normal, and texture data. All right, so I've just taken the size of that structure, multiplied it by the number of vertices that you have, and that is your byte width for this buffer. Again, we let it know that it is a vertex buffer, and that's what we would like to bind this to in the graphics driver or graphics systems hardware. We'd like to bind this to a nice vertex buffer so it can utilize it as fast as possible. We don't need the CPU to read or write to this data anymore, so we're going to set the flags to 0. Again, that's an advanced feature. The system memory that we should be pointing at is wherever we've stored our sumo vertices in our system memory in the game, so we give it that reference to the array. Of course, we try to create the buffer, and it's always nice to see if it failed, just in case you know your graphics card doesn't support whatever you're trying to do, or the hardware you're working on doesn't. So that's what this sort of helper class does, is just see if an error occurred and then present it to you in a nice manner. But otherwise, we're just creating the buffer like we saw in the sample code, pass in our buffer description, the initial data, and that vertex buffer itself, and that will create our buffer for us. Again, we have to make a buffer for our index system as well. And so again, how many indices do we have? In this case, it's an unsigned int or unsigned short in size, so that's word. So size of word, get that, multiply that. We get our size of the bit width for that buffer. We tell it it's an index buffer now, so it uses it in a different way. Again, no special CPU flags or anything like that. We point it to our system memory that has those indices, and we create that buffer as well. So really just this part is the only difference between the two create buffer commands, because we've effectively just overwritten our previous buffer description variable or structure with the new information that we're going to use to create that buffer. So that would create our sumo mesh on sort of, and push all that data that it needs to know to the graphics device for us to sort of see what's going on and render it at some point later on. All right, so I'm going to step back out of this. I'll go back to the slides for a bit. There we go. Perfect. So we've taken a look at that sumo mesh, setting it up, getting all the vertices in there, getting all the connecting lines for your polygons, for the triangles, to lay that all out. Now, in order to manipulate that and to even see it, we're going to need 3 4x4 matrices, okay, that are going to represent the position of that object and its rotation and tumble and anything else, its scale. Okay, that's one of the matrices. Then we're going to need another one for our view, which is effectively our camera. And then we're going to need another one for projecting that information into a 2D space to show on the screen. So in order to do all this manipulation, all that, we do need these three matrices that we're going to effectively apply and multiply to each of those vertices when the system goes to render them. So the 4x4 matrix, it's basically is just your basic transformation matrix. If you've done linear algebra or some complicated math like that and had some fun in that class, I'm sure you've seen how a 4x4 matrix is laid out with an identity matrix, for example, is 1 all the way down the column and everything else is 0. The first three along that major axis control your scale, and rotations are all done in different ways, and transposition or translations are usually, depending on if you're row or column major, at the bottom or at the far side. Those are those matrices that we're going to use here with all of that data plugged in to manipulate that vertex to wherever it should be, and then to manipulate it according to the camera, and then finally to your screen to present to the user. Now, do we have to do all that crazy math all the time for every single vertex? No, obviously your system is going to handle that for you. You're just going to set it up. The graphics card is going to grind it out way faster than you can, and then it's going to get it up on screen for you. So typically, that first matrix that converts the model's coordinates into world space, like where it should be, is known as the world matrix because it takes you through that process. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not to say that there is one of them. There isn't. There's effectively one of them for every object to get that object into world space. Mm-hmm. All right. So when we built our cube, for example, it was all centered around 000, and we built it out as if in local position to that origin. But that doesn't mean every cube exists in the center of your game world, no. Right? Even though that's what that is. So the world matrix is going to take that local space 0 to 1 or 1 to -1 position or whatever you did to model your indices and vertexes, translate them into where it actually is in the environment, what size it is, and so on. So that's the principal point of this world matrix and what it does or how it helps us out. Now, typically, we have the next one is known as the view matrix. It converts that world space coordinates into camera space. So again, it's going to do same kind of math, only it's from the point of view of where the camera is. So now we're taking that into perspective, and we're figuring out where is the camera looking at this scene. Oh, he's actually looking at the left of the cube. So I shouldn't be rendering it just as if the cube is facing the camera. Now I got to render it sideways. So it's going to do those translations to get everything from the point of view of your camera looking into the world now that everything's in the world position. And so that's what that one does. And then finally, the projection matrix converts the coordinates from camera space or from camera space into screen space to actually get the pixels, the right pixels, which gives you, we call it a projection matrix. There's also, sometimes this is called a orthographic matrix because sometimes, such as in 2D games, you don't actually care about depth, like how far an object is away. And in a projection matrix or a perspective matrix, that we can use as a projection matrix, it does matter. One hand in front of the other, one looks smaller than the other from the point of view of the camera. So the projection matrix can sort of shift between orthographic or perspective mode, whichever one you want. If you want depth or you don't want depth, you can bend your FOV, your field of view, okay? In many shooter games, for example, you have control of that to like widen it so you can sort of get more peripheral vision if you've got a widescreen monitor or whatever. Or you can give yourself a fisheye lens so everything's all, like bubbly as if you're underwater and zipping by you at weird angles. That's all controlled in the projection matrix. That's what we're going to be dealing with in there. So, again, because that model matrix changes before we render each object, the game is going to store that one separately from our other two. Right? Every model needs its own world matrix. So we're going to put it in one of those different buffers that we talked about earlier because it gets updated more often. The view one maybe gets updated once per frame. So that's going to go in that once per frame buffer that we talked about. And we saw that. We saw the camera get view. They were pulling that view matrix out. That's exactly what it was doing. It was requesting this 4x4 matrix. So that's where that's going to go. So projection and view matrices are separate and usually stored in a different area. The world matrix is stored per object to represent everything that object has, and it gets passed in every time we render a new object. So there is a little bit of difference in how we handle those and where we store them. Now, one other thing to note is DirectX Math does use row major matrices. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it can be used directly with HLSL, the high-level shader language, matrices that are defined with row major as a keyword. So that there, just like the back face calling, front face calling, you have to look at your shader and which way is it dealing with. Well, in this case, you have to look at the shader and go, is it trying to do it in row major form or column major form? And depending on what is set, it'll either work perfectly with DirectX Math, or you'll have to do a transposition of the matrix to effectively flip it and invert it so that it will work in column major form or vice versa. All right, so you'll see in our demo, actually, that we do transpose these matrices every time we go to use them. And that's to get, because of the shaders, the order it expects is different than the default DirectX setup. So just something to keep in note. If you see things moving in the wrong direction or not manipulating right, it might be simply because of that, and you'll want to take a look at that. So we're going to inspect the camera class, which is where I've put the view matrix, for example. It's in the camera class. It makes sense for it. That's, you know, where you would expect to find it, since it effectively is the camera itself. I forgot to exit. There we go. And shift over. All right, so here let me grab the camera class here, which if you go under game objects, that's where the camera class is. So we have both the header again and the CPP. And if we take a glance at the header, let me blow this up for you so it's a bit easier to read. There we go. Again, it really is just about defining the position, the orientation, and the viewing frustum of a camera looking into the 3D world. So it's going to generate both our view matrix and our projection matrix. So we're going to need helper functions for that, so that other functionality, such as when somebody crushes the screen, mm-hmm. it can set the projection parameters for our field of view, or our aspect ratio, more notably, would be the one that would get changed if you manipulated the screen size of the game, and so on. So all of those things go in here. For example, for the view projection, it's a camera, so we need to know where it is. That's known as the eye position. Mm-hmm. So again, it's just a float three. Where is it? And then we have, where is it looking? So what is it looking at? And finally, which way is up for the camera? Because you can look at something, but you can hold the camera upside down if you wish. And that's useful for if you're doing a flight game and you want to do a barrel roll from the cockpit point of view. You just manipulate this up vector to constantly point from up to right to down to left and back to up. And he did one full revolution around the rolling axis. So that's a nice way for us to control what our camera is going to be viewing, and it changes our view projection. And the projection parameters, like I said, field of view, aspect ratio, the near and far clipping plane. Near and far clipping plane, that's near plane is how close can something be to the front of the camera before it doesn't render? Mm-hmm. And this sort of simulates, I'm sure you've seen this in news footage, somebody be carrying a camera, and eventually the guy walks right into the camera. But he got too close. He hit the near plane. That's that near plane there. When they bang up against the camera, they got too close, they hit that near plane. Now, we don't physically have a camera, so you'll just see through the object as it passes through that near plane. You've probably seen that in other games, most notably, you know, third person driving around, smashing up action games. You can zoom in to try to get a closer view of your guy, or you ram him into a corner and the camera punches in, it'll go inside his head and you'll sort of see the cutout and you'll see the eyeballs floating around, right? That's that back face culling, but also our near clipping plane is removing the geometry right where the camera is so that we can see at least that far forward. And that's what you're seeing there. The far plane is how far away can we still see something, right? So we want to specify how close for that front of the camera is and how far away it is, and that's really what we're doing there. So those are just some basic camera stuff that you can manipulate. And again, we have our helper functions for changing just the look or just the eye position of the camera. And then we have all of our matrices and all of our float vector forms functions. So could I please have the position of the camera? And it hands it back as a float three. Could I get the projection matrix? Could I get the view matrix of the camera? It'll hand them back as XM matrices, and so on and so on. If you needed to know what the near clip plane or the far clip plane was, you can ask for that, and so on and so on. And here we are storing our actual 4x4 matrices that that hold that view matrix and that projection matrix data. We also have an inverse view just for usability purposes, so we don't have to calculate it on the, all the time. We can just grab it internally there and store it and use it maybe a couple extra times per frame before we have to recalculate it. Then we have the eye position, look position, up position, and so on and so on, all the internal settings for the view angle, the near plane, and all of that. So it's as basic as you can really make a camera system, but still have the functionality you're going to need for a 3D game. That's what I've really trimmed it down to for all of you to use. Now, in the camera class itself, when we create a camera, it just sets that view parameters up to some basic defaults. So the default position is going to be the origin of the world. The default look is down Z, because typically in 3D games, we consider Z being into positive Z being into the screen. Sometimes it's positive Z is out of the screen, but in this case, I've set it to into the screen. So the camera starts set up looking in that default presentation that we would expect. And of course, up is Y. So we say 0, 1, 0 for the default up vector. And then we just set the projection parameters. So the near clipping plane is going to be 1 unit away. The farthest we can see is 1,000 units. And then things just stop rendering beyond that. And the FOV is going to be 1/4 pi in this case to start. So going through these functions, the most important ones really are just the ones that are going to give us that view and that projection matrix, and they're just going to hand it back as is from internally. There's also a world one, but that's just where the camera is inversed. It's a little bit, it's not exactly, we're never going to render the camera. So we don't need to worry about that. In some games, actually, they do when they have multiple cameras. Sometimes you see like a camera icon where the other camera is and so on, but not in this case. The rest of these are all just helper functions that just give you the specific data you asked for, and that's it for the camera. So the camera really just, the most important thing is that it holds this view and projection matrix for us to use when rendering everything else in the game. That's really what the camera class is all about. All right, so popping back here now. So now we know where we're going to store that data. And now that we've seen where those matrices live and how they're stored and we've talked about what they're used for, we're going to need to alter that world matrix right before we render an object to the actual rendering device. We basically have to transport that part or that version of the world matrix to the graphics card so it renders all of that vertices data properly for that mesh. So the alterations need to be stored somewhere. So we've abstracted the fact that there's only one world matrix at a time on the graphics card, and we've instead created a world matrix in each game object. At that point, most games are going to create a class called game object, so I have done so as well, or they just call it object or you know, whatever, base piece or something like that. And that's going to be our base class for all objects in the game. And since all objects in the game have a position, generally speaking, and a rotation and a scale, that the major thing that this class is going to store is simply that world matrix for any object that extends from that class. That's all that's going to be in there data-wise. So that's where we store it. So we got our view and our projection in our camera class, and we're going to have an individual world matrix, effectively, data in each game object that we create. So our two sumo wrestlers are going to have their own world matrix in their game object classes, and our cylinder for the base for the ground also has its own world matrix that we render in that fashion. Now, once we have all of those in position, we need to create a series of constant buffers that we've talked about before, the never changes buffer. All right, we got the change on resize buffer, the changes every frame buffer, and the change every primitive buffer. So to declare those, again, they're just default buffers. Okay, just like the vertex buffer was a default buffer, the index buffer was a D3D11 buffer, they're all just basic buffers. And that's why we need to hand descriptions along with the data so that the graphics card knows how to interpret it. So each one of these, again, are just basic buffers. So we've declared them with a COM pointer, pointing to those interface structures that are going to be our basic buffer. So we start by creating the buffer description, so D3D11 buffer description again. Then we use md3d device create buffer with that description to get it over onto the device. And finally, you fill in the data via your original COM pointer that we've declared right here for that buffer whenever it changes. So if I wanted to change the window size because they've resized it, I would talk to the M constant buffer change on resize dot projection matrix and change the field of view or the aspect ratio or whatever in there because it's going to be in that buffer. So these pointers now are what we're going to manipulate whenever we need to effectively manipulate the data that's on the device itself. Okay, because now we've told it to look at this memory and constantly send that over whenever required. Okay, so inspecting the game object and the children. I'm just going to do this quickly again, pop out here for a second. We're just going to, now that we have that game object class, I just want to point you at them and sort of show you what is in there. So here is the game object's header. Again, it's pretty basic. It's going to have a render function, which really is just going to call the game object's mesh. Okay, the game object is going to be made up effectively of the mesh of the object. So in this case, in the future when we make our sumo block, which you can see right here, our sumo block class, it's going to extend game object, but a sumo block needs a mesh and where and what it is positionally. So there's the mesh object pointer, and we're going to have our model matrix, I've called it in this case, but because it's currently just for this model, which is what's going to become the world matrix when we go to render this model. Mm-hmm. All right, so that's just sort of the labeling difference. So when you want the model matrix so that you can take it and effectively convert it into the world matrix, that's the thing you're going to be after. And of course, we can just change the position or the velocity as needed. And there's this update position because all of these game objects are going to need their position to be updated. So I've made that virtual function for you to override for any new game objects you make. And let's just jump over the sumo block here. Oh, sorry. Go to the header for the sumo block. And again, this might be a little small, so let's just zoom in there a bit. There we go. So the sumo block extends from our game object class. Okay, it needs to take in its position. And in this case, a sumo, we're going to give it a target, the other guy, right? This is a guy you should be, like, facing, you should be charging at, you should be pushing. So the constructor takes a position and that target. And same thing, we could change the target in case you want to put a multiplayer mode in later or like a holdout mode where there's 20 sumos all at once and they're all trying to push each other out as your own expansion to the game, then that's fine. So I just provided you a function to allow you to change the target on the fly.
I kind of want to see this 20 sumo sumos mode.
could be entertaining. I don't know how easy it would be. You might get beat quite often, but it'd be cool. So what we've added here is that the sumo also needs a rotation matrix, so I've given it one. It needs to know about that target. And finally, it's going to have an angle that represents the rotation that we've put in that matrix. So these are something that the base game object didn't have. Mm-hmm. And so I've just expanded and put them in here. So the target controlling part and storing that information, that's all built upon the game object, which does still have our model matrix, which becomes our world matrix and so on, and our render function. So if we jump over to the CPP, and I actually have to open this so I can zoom it up again. There we go. If I just scroll down here to our update position function on line 40, we check if we have a target. If we do have a target, then we want to always make that sumo wrestler face the enemy. I mean, you don't, running sideways at him or backwards, you don't see that in sumo wrestling. It's all like facing the guy, pushing as hard as you can, that kind of stuff. So we're going to do that for our little cubes. We're going to make him rotate to always face the position of the enemy. And to do that, we basically just take our target's position, which we have a reference to him. So we ask for his position in vector form. Okay, that's all that this function does, as opposed to the position in float3 form. Mm-hmm. So we're grabbing it in vector form because in DirectX, you can subtract two vectors and it'll return you a vector. The minus sign is overloaded to do that. Whereas a float3, it wouldn't work out. So we've kept it in vector form, and our position I've asked for in vector form, and that's why there's nothing in front of this. So this is just our position, our target position. If we subtract our position from the target position, that gives me a vector facing my target. I can then normalize that so it's just a direction. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to calculate the angle between two normals, in this case our direction, and the forward-facing direction of the model, which I've decided is X positive X. All right, it's going to measure the distance, or the degrees, rather, between this, or radians, actually, is what it'll probably be in, between our facing and the current direction we need to face to get looking at our enemy. So that answer comes back. We save it as our angle internally. We're then going to see if we're in the upper arc of the map. So because of the way the system returns it, it's going to give us a 0 to 180. Because it's going to be the closest angle to get to that. Mm-hmm. So if I have to do too much of a spin around one way or the other, it's going to give me the short angle, and I'm not going to turn in the right direction. So you'll only be facing your target half the time. Otherwise, you'll start to rotate the other way around to face him again when he's the other way. So I've just put this little check in to verify, basically, if the Z component of our direction is positive, then I know we're on one side of the arena mat. And if it's negative, I'm facing the other side of the arena map, and I'm just going to invert the angle into the negative version of it. And that's going to allow us to do full 360-degree spins in either direction to face our target automatically. Again, we're not controlling this. The code is just going to be doing this, rotating the cube to always face the other cube. So then what we have to do is we have to build our new model matrix, that world matrix to render them, and we do that by taking any scaling we wish to do to the sumo. In this case, I've made the cube the size I want, so I need no scaling in X, Y, or Z, so I just say 1, 1, and 1 for each X, Y, and Z component, and say, could you please, DirectX, give me a scaling matrix, which will be effectively a 4x4 matrix. It'll hand that back using this scale of 1, 1, 1. And I'm going to multiply that matrix by our rotation matrix around the angle we need to rotate. He only rotates around the y-axis, which points straight up in the air. So I can make a matrix rotation y using that angle. Again, these functions, these XM matrix rotations and things like XM vector set, those are all part of that DirectX API. And it is different than DirectX 10, that's why, and previous versions. Some people were asking, you know, what are the differences? This would be one of those things you would have to change. Okay, you would have to change any of this math to do it the old way in whichever way you were doing in whatever version of DirectX that you're rolling back to. So that is one of those differences that somebody was asking about earlier on in the chat. But all of these are from our XM Math API. And finally, after we've rotated, we've scaled, we've rotated, now we actually have to move him to wherever he is currently standing. So we just make a translation matrix using his position of X, Y, and Z, and that finally combines together into our full 4x4 model matrix.
It's probably a good thing to point out, too, that the order of which you do these operations is very important.
It is important. You can't just throw them in any order. Yeah. There, especially when you're dealing with, for example, two angles, okay, rotation around Y or X, or just Z and X, the order does matter. You may have to play with it a little bit. When you get into something complex like that, actually look up how to build a world matrix out of those things. There's also an orbit rotation.
I was going to say, I remember it by ISROT, right?
Yes,
the identity, ISROT. Scaling, rotation, orbit, translation.
Perfect, exactly. For those that you don't know, he was a student of mine at one point, so I'm glad to see that he can quote that.
It stuck.
That's good. It stuck. So yeah, ISROT is one way to actually remember that kind of information and the order in which you should be doing these things. So again, you can look that up whenever you need to do something more complex. You'll get all that information, and you'll be able to lay it out as such. Okay, so that is how we build, for example, our Sumo's Worlds Matrix at any point in time, and allows us then to pass that to the graphics card, as well as our view and our projection from the camera class. We now almost have everything we need to finally render something to the screen. Again, there is a lot of setup, but once you have it all, it does work quite nicely. It fits together relatively easy, and expanding on that to do other objects, isn't that difficult to do. Sorry, I just got to jump through a bunch of slides to get us back to where we were. I forgot the shift button. Whee! All right, so where were we here? Manipulating an object, perfect. All right, so now we're on to rendering the mesh. We have the mesh. We have everything we need to see the mesh. We have the ability to translate the mesh around and move it in 3D space. The next step on our path is rendering that mesh to create a basic vertex and pixel shader using the high-level shader language, HLSL. Both can be written in a single file if you choose. You don't have to write a vertex shader or a pixel shader in their own. And most people will write them in separate files just so that it's easy to manipulate and jump between them. Okay, so the vertex shader, there's a vertex shader HLSL file and a pixel shader HLSL file that you can find in the project there. There's actually two other ones also in there that are flat shaders. Basically, they strip out lighting.
Yeah.
Okay, that kind of thing. Or they do it in a different manner. So we're also going to create a separate file just for those buffers. To help manage them, it's easier to find them that way. Some people will stick them in with their shaders, but then when you need to change the layout of your vertices, for example, now maybe you want color data instead of texture data because mm-hmm. you're shifting to a mobile platform and you don't need all that detail. You'd have to go and find whatever random shader file has the buffers in them, and they could be in more than one place. Right? They might have. So it's easier, I find, to set up a separate file. In this case, we've just labeled it as a .hlsli file, okay, for that information purposes. And we've called it constant buffer. So that's what's in the constant buffer HLSLI file. It's just going to be that data layout. Now, what do vertex shaders do? I've mentioned them previously, as an introductory sort of overview. It's a process. The process in which we take a mesh's vertices and we can perform things like transformations, skinning, or lighting on it, and then hand it off to the pixel shader to do some more overlays or something like that. So you can do it for facial features. You can have them scrunch up their face and so on, like this character here smiling and frowning and doing all that, just by manipulating the vertices with a vertex shader. All right, so we're not actually changing the model in terms of in the code, but the shader is doing that in some manner. They always operate on just a single input vertex, and they produce a single output vertex. So it's a one-to-one. It doesn't create anything, not like the tessellation system and the geometry shaders that I briefly mentioned in that. They make more vertices, mm-hmm. okay, or more geometry. Vertex shaders can only manipulate already existing ones. That's what they do. So this stage of the rendering pipeline has to always be active, or we'd see nothing. So that's just sort of, I just pointed out because it has to be there. And then pixel shaders lets you do crazy effects like this, where it's not about rendering the thing, it's about changing what you have rendered now into some stylized approach. So pixel shaders are also sometimes known as fragment shaders because they're now dealing with a piece of your overall picture. Okay, so they can compute color and other attributes per pixel or fragment. And they can alter the depth of the fragment, for example. We do this for Z buffering purposes, and it's a way to remove geometry we don't need to see and so on. We can use different techniques like that. And we can also create a bunch of two-dimensional post-processing effects like blurring or mosaicing it, sepia tones, swirls, embossing, whatever you want, colorizing, so you can make it green fog like those penguins in the top right, or monochroming it by removing all the color like the penguins in the middle. You can do all those kinds of post-processy like effects now that the image is rendered. That's what the pixel shaders really deal with. So we're just going to jump in and take a brief look at those shaders. We're not going to spend too much time on them. I've provided them with you. They will work seamlessly, basically, hopefully for you, bringing in textures you can and manipulate those and see what they look like. You could also go back to look at that original sample with the multicolored cube, look at its pixel shader and its vertex shader, which are even more simplified because they don't have the lighting data or the texture data. They just have the vertex position and color information. So if you just want simple tune colored objects, you can go use those. Just bring them in, load them in, see where we're loading these HLSL files. Just do a search through the code. You'll find it. HLSL doesn't come up very much, especially .hlsl. So you'll find the two spots where we're loading it. You can swap in those other files and then refer to them similarly. But you will have to change the vertex buffer data because the layout of the vertices is going to be different and so on, because you'll need that color data. Not so much to remove the normal or the other the texture coordinate. Doesn't matter if there's extra data, but you need those two that it actually expects. So I'm just going to pop over here to the code. I'll take a quick little gander at that. Right, so here we are in the code base. And if I go down to shaders, and I open this up, you can see there's five files in here, one of which is our constant buffer file, index file, basically, that has all the information in it. And let me zoom this up a bit. There we go. So what do we store in the buffer that never changes? Well, the lighting position, actually, in this game. I don't move the lights. The lights don't move anywhere. They don't change colors. So they never, ever change, no matter what. So we put that in that buffer. We now never have to update the graphics card again with that information. Once it has it, it'll be happy. Our change on resize, just the projection matrix, because that changes our aspect ratio. So that is something the projection matrix controls, so we need that. Things that change every frame happen to be our view matrix, the camera. Where is the camera? That changes every frame. Then the constant buffer changes every primitive. That's our world matrix, our mesh color, diffuse specular color, which is our lighting colors that we're going to be using, how the lights affect the object, and so on. Those change every primitive. And then finally, also the vertex shader input. This is where we tell it you're going to get a position, you're going to get a normal, and you're going to get a texture UV, which will match the buffer description elements. If we go and look at those, you'll see that unlike the sample, which only had position and color, I now have position, normal, and text coord 0. Okay, that's what those refer to, that same setup that we did with the buffer descriptions, but now we're going to have 3 elements instead of 2 elements with similar settings as before. All right, so that's what that looks like. Now, we're going to look at the pixel shader. Actually, no, I'll go to the vertex shader first. Since it does happen in that order, vertex shader does happen first, you'll see that the code more or less, you know, looks like C++ still, but it is written in HLSL. So one thing we expect is the vertex shader manipulates a single vertex and exports a single vertex out. So we bring one in using that vertex shader input structure that we just saw a second ago, and we're going to make a pixel shader input structure. We're going to call it output because that's the output of the vertex shader. Mm-hmm. And right now we're just going to set it to 0 or null as that class. And we now start manipulating the vertex. In this case, we're going to change the vertex position by taking the input position. So that'll be in local coordinates. So it'll be, for example, the top left or front left corner of the cube is 0.5, 0.5, 0.5. That's going to be multiplied by our world matrix for wherever the sumo is. And that could translate it to 50, 25, 10. Then we take that, we multiply it by how the camera is viewing this object in that world, and that'll change its coordinates again. And then finally, we multiply it by the projection matrix as well to get it into screen space. So that vertex now has gone from local coordinates to world coordinates to the camera's view coordinates to the finally where it should be on screen coordinate. All right, now you see that we have to use this mul for multiply function to actually do this work. Okay, we can't use the multiply symbol. You can't use a star for that in HLSL for what we're trying to do with this vertex and these matrices. So we use the multiply command or function effectively and pass in the information to do that. Now the texture coordinate, nothing's going to change in this shader. We just pass it along. We're not going to manipulate it at all. We then have to compute our normal. Remember, we had those little normals pointing off all the corners. Well, they need to be translated into the world view and then the camera view and so on, so that we get it from the right direction to calculate lighting properly. When you look at a shiny surface from a different angle, you're going to see glare. For example, there's a light here beside me. I can see glare coming off my hand, and as I tilt my hand, I get a different glare. And that's because that normal on my hand is moving around as well, according to where I put it in the world and how my eyes are viewing it. So those two things have to be multiplied together and combined on that normal, and that's what that line of code there is doing. It's outputting the new position and coordinates of that normal for that vertex. Then next, the next line of code here, vertex position and view space. So we're going to normalize it for the pixel shader's sort of range of values. So we're setting the vertex to I position by taking the input position again, multiply it by the world, multiply it by the view, but then we're going to invert the X, Y, and Z values afterwards. So that's the direction from that vertex in space to our eyeball or our camera position. Okay, that's just useful for certain lighting effects, so we're just pre-calculating that now while we're in here. And then finally, we need to know where all of our lights are So we take our light position arrays, which we haven't looked at, but we've basically just hard-coded in four lights, and you can just right-click on this and say go to declaration. It'll show you where it is. And we've just set them up in the world. You could change those if you want, you change their colors and so on. But we're just taking that position again, multiplying it by where the camera is, and then we're using the vertex to eye direction that we just calculated, adding that on to that normalized direction for the light, and that sort of gives us our skewed perspective of that light from our camera point of view and so on. That's going to be interacted with that vertex, and that's going to be used by the pixel shader, which if I jump over to right here, now this is going to get into lighting topics and so on. We're not going to really do anything there. And I'll blow this up again. There we go. So we're not going to spend much time in this. We could go over the different ways to do lighting and different types of lighting and so on, backlighting and so on.
There's a lot of them, yes.
And there are lots of them, directional light, specular lighting, and so on. So really, this is just taking that output, but now we rename it input, but it's still that pixel shader input structure, and it's now using all of the vertex to light zero, those things we just calculated, and manipulating them, doing dot products and all this to calculate the lighting in different ways, to do our specular lighting and so on. We multiply our color by the amount of light being reflected in that direction to you and add that in. And then we sample the UV coordinate for this vertex from our diffuse texture, okay? And we take that, we're going to multiply it by the diffuse color, which is from our lighting component and so on, and the diffuse luminance, and then add on our specular hotspot kind of reflective shiny surface light to that. So it's going to get the color from the texture at this point. That's what this this function does here. So diffuse texture is our reference to that texture, whatever it is that we're using. We're going to sample it at this position, okay, and we're going to multiply that by any color tinting from lighting that we have and pump it out. And that's really what this shader does. Obviously, there's a little bit of complicated math and doing all the geometry behind that to figure that out. Don't worry about that. The point is to show you, you know, these are the kinds of things we can do with a shader. They're pretty basic. In the end, a vertex shader manipulates vertices. A pixel shader manipulates the actual color of that point on screen and so on. All right, so let's pop back now. And we'll continue on. We're almost done this section. There's just two more slides to go effectively, and then we'll take a little break. So make sure I hit the right key combination so I don't have to scroll through everything. All right, so we've looked at the shaders, and now after the shaders, we have everything we need to render an object. Okay, that is a lot of setup, that is a lot of work, but the reason why we did a little bit of that extra work is to make it easier later on. Building those mesh object classes, okay, and those other classes like the game object and so on, and the ones that extend from it, just allow us to manipulate that data much easier. You saw how simple a lot of those classes were. There weren't a lot of functions to them. It was mostly variables being stored, some helper functions to get the values in different formats, and that's it. And really, that's what you want. Nice, simple, easy to manipulate code, easy to bring to your next game and continue on, so on and so on. And that's really what we wanted to do.
Well, you're building an engine is what you're doing right
yes.
now. You're literally building an engine that you can use later on in many games, right?
Exactly. So. It's about building that foundation again, right?
Yeah.
Just like you said, building a foundation for a 3D project that you can then bring out and do multiple things with. Now, with that in mind, instancing and referencing, this is a way, now that we have the separation of data in terms of where is the object, how is it rotated, from the physical piece of the game, which is the vertices and the individual points and so on, what we're going to do is that sumo mesh, we're going to bend space and time so that we can use the same mesh, the same chunk of memory, but to draw multiple sumo objects all over the screen wherever we wanted to. Okay, so that instancing, I'm going to make an instance of something. So it creates an object from the same base template as another object as before. But referencing is, you know, could you please refer to this guy when talking to whoever? So what we're going to do is we saw that mesh reference was in the game object class. So we only need one sumo block mesh, and we need multiple sumos that then refer to that same mesh. So let's just pop into the code, and I'll show that last bit before we wrap this section up. Oh, and I forgot to exit. There we go. Boop. Okay, so again, what we're going to do here is if we look at sumo block, actually, we'll just look at the header. So the sumo block has the game information. It extends from game object. Okay, so it can be you. Mm-hmm. And then I'm the other sumo. All right, we're different people. But in this game, they're going to look exactly the same. So we don't need two different bodies. We just need to be in two different places at once. And so that's what we're going to do. So the sumo block doesn't have any of that information. It has where each of us are rotated and who our enemy is. And if I go to the game object and pump that up, the game object, again, has the mesh information down here. And it has the model matrix where you are, where I am. So the game object as a whole has where it is and what you should be. But then it simply references, okay, via this pointer, this manage pointer, a mesh. And it's going to be the exact same mesh, both of which are going to use the sumo mesh right here, which again has all of our, I'll go to the header, doesn't really have anything except for our actual pixel layout, our vertex and our index layout for a cube. We're both cubes, mm-hmm. but there's no positional data here. So where we both are at the same time doesn't matter. So if we jump over, and I know this is a lot of jumping around, if I jump over to the game class down here, sumo DX, CBP, and we look at where we set up the game to start. All right, that would be in the initialize right here. There it is here. Starting at line 53, we can see that we create a sumo block instance, all right, for the player. We give them a position, and we push that into the render array. Then we create an enemy sumo block. What AI sumo block just extends from sumo block, so it has an AI and the player can't control it. And we go ahead and we push that one in. But neither one of those knows anything about the mesh yet. We haven't created a mesh for those things. We've just created that class. Nowhere up here do we create the actual instance of those meshes. So both of their meshes effectively don't exist at this point. If we go down here just a little bit further, we create a cylinder mesh, or a cylinder game object for the floor, we create our camera, and we continue on. What'll happen is, later on, we're gonna actually build that instance of the block itself, which I'll just jump to here, sumo mesh. Oh, and I'm not even in the right file, so I'll just do that. Because I've forgotten what line of code this is on. There it is there. Thank you. Get out of there. All right, so in the game renderer, it's probably a little bit too big. There we go. In the game renderer is where we're actually creating the sumo mesh during its initialization, all right, and we're letting the sumo mesh know about the device. And all we're going to do is we're going to go through every object, and we saw that we were pushing both the player and the enemy sumo into that render object array. So we're grabbing the render object array from the game, and now during the initialization of the game renderer, we're checking what kind of object he is. Oh, he's an enemy sumo. You know what? Your mesh is this mesh that we've made. And if I just scroll down to here to the player, sumo block, he uses the same sumo mesh. I haven't created two instances of the mesh object. It's the same mesh object, and it doesn't matter. But both those player and enemy now will draw based on the same object. So that's just a way of referencing one model, even though we have multiple instances of the sumos. We have one model. We don't have the extra overhead for three different models or anything like that. And that's a common practice, setting up things in this way where we have the separation of the data for that character versus his actual physical look and feel and textures and so on. And that allows us to make many, many different crates that you can crack and break all independently, power-ups laid all over the environment, enemies that all look the same. Now, you usually don't want that, yeah, but
lots of trees.
Yeah, lots of trees, exactly. That's a great one. Trees everywhere, but you don't want to load 5,000 vertices for every tree times 5,000 trees. That forest would be massive and unrenderable, basically, at this point in the game. So this allows us to have all that stuff. Okay, so that's a big overview. It is a huge chunk to get something rendering, to see something on screen, and all of that. So next up, I guess we're gonna have a lunch break.
You know, we'll take about a 30-minute break, grab some lunch and that. I don't know if you guys are hearing it on the camera, my stomach's starting to rumble a little bit, so I wouldn't mind grabbing a little bite to eat there. And when we come back, we'll jump in again and we'll take a look at some state management.
Yeah, perfect.
All right.